This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
There are two opposing forces in this economy right now. Well, there are more than that, but the two biggies, economic growth and the trade war. Discuss amongst yourselves. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 26th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The number of the day this Friday is 3.5%. That's how much the economy grew in the summer quarter, July through September. But because you knew there was going to be a but, numbers are nothing without context, which is A, why we're here. But it's also B, why Nela Richardson from Edward Jones and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post are in our studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. In the process of asking this question, I'm going to point out that we're going to be hearing from Tracy Samuelson in about 6 minutes or so on some of the details of the GDP report as it deals with trade. But a very quick pass on this GDP report. It is a good number.
Yeah, the headline number is good. There are some underlying parts of it that are a little bit troubling, including the fact that business investment had slowed. You know, there is this risk that the boost to capital expenditures was pretty front-loaded this year as a result of the tax cuts, and we're seeing a slowdown. So that is a little bit troubling. But generally, the headline number was good. Consumers seem happy.
Nela, it occurs to me, actually, just thinking back to how I opened the show, what I should have said there is that there are three forces, right? Economic growth, the trade war, and also the tax cuts, because there's a tension there between the trade war and the tax cuts and the stimulus and the unstimulus, if you will, of what's going on.
Let's boil it down to two things. One is higher interest rates, which the stimulus feeds into, and stronger growth. And right now, for a short period of time, maybe, we are at an economic sweet spot where the economy can still grow, but inflation is still very moderate. In fact, below the Fed target rate of 2% in this latest GDP read. And so right now, things are looking good, economically speaking, and it's good, as Catherine said, because the consumer is good.
I hear some trepidation, though, in your voice, Nela.
You know, there's no such thing as a perfect economy.
Okay.
And part of the reason that markets were worried this week, and we saw that in the stock market this week, is there are these three persistent concerns: slower global growth, higher interest rates, and tariff and trade tension concerns. Those are going to stay with us until they're resolved. And so you'll see this push-pull in the market between really strong fundamentals and a very worried outlook for investors ahead.
Okay. Catherine, not to point out the president's economic inconsistencies, but it bears a mention.
Please point them out.
Well. So here's the thing. Just on this trade and tariff thing, he came out this week in a tweet at some point Monday, Tuesday, and said, we're going to get billions of dollars into the United States because of all these tariffs, not mentioning that consumers are going to pay those tariffs. But then he turns around in an interview with the Wall Street Journal and says, tariffs? We don't have any tariffs on this economy. I don't understand, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, and in that very same Wall Street Journal article, he also talked about how useful the tariffs had been.
Well, yeah.
So, like, basically in the same breath, you know, on the one hand, he's saying we have these tariffs. On the other hand, he's saying the tariffs don't exist. It can make your head spin a little bit. And you can understand why it has been so difficult for some of our trading partners, potentially, to negotiate with the people who have been dispatched to negotiate on behalf of the United States. If they don't really know what the president wants, if the president is inconsistent about not only what he wants, but actually what he's already been doing, then that can be that can make it very difficult to make any sort of progress. And, you know, when I've talked with business groups, when I've talked with business owners, they have expressed a lot of concern about the uncertainty that comes from the fact that Trump does not seem to have a particularly sophisticated understanding of international trade or clear goals, for that matter, about what he's trying to get out of these negotiations.
Neela, another item from that Wall Street Journal interview, and one has to say it's a goal, right, is to put pressure on the Federal Reserve. He once again called the Fed, chaired by Jay Powell, his biggest economic problem. Even as Chairman Powell told me back in June, even as the Fed doesn't pay any attention to what the president says, one does wonder if now with some signs, perhaps the economy might not be all that it will be for too much longer. And the Fed might be thinking about rates. What does this kind of pressure, you suppose, do to the mind of Jay Powell?
Well, you know, it makes a hard job even that much harder, right? So what the Fed is really concerned about is how to keep the economic bull market running, how to keep economic growth in step while still normalizing policy. Because when and if, and we know that it will be a win eventually, the next recession hits, he wants to make sure that his toolkit is as fully ready to stop the slowdown as possible. And that means raising short-term interest rates. It's a very effective tool. The Fed has been using it for years, and they want to make sure that tool's ready for the next recession. And they want to do so in a context of economic growth. And so that's what's happening here, a very moderate increase in short-term interest rates from zero, right? Mm-hmm. So along that path, any politicalization of a very moderate increase in rates makes his job all the more tricky.
Right.
And that's what has to be negotiated going forward.
Neela Richardson at Edward Jones, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post on a Friday in New York City. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, a down day to end an up and down week. And let me say one more time, I think like the fourth time this week I've said this, this is normal. This is what's supposed to happen. Markets go up, they go down. But it has been a while since things have felt this choppy, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, back we are going to go to that GDP report from this morning because, you know, A-list economic indicator and all that. As Catherine and Neela and I were saying, it's a pretty good number. Credit where credit is due. But you dig a little deeper, as we are wont to do around here, and you can start to separate what is boosting economic growth, consumer spending, for instance, from what is not helping growth all that much at all. One of those drags last quarter was trade. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what's going on there.
So how much faster would the economy have grown without this drag from trade?
You would have seen a much larger growth rate, probably closer to over 5%.
Beth Ann Bovino is chief U.S. economist at S&P Global.
What you saw was exports down pretty sharply. Imports were up pretty sharply.
Together, that shaved nearly 2 percentage points off of GDP growth. Bovino says imports were driven by a strong dollar, which is making foreign products a good deal. Plus, she says companies were replenishing their inventories, filling up their shelves ahead of the holidays. They may also be trying to get ahead of tariffs on Chinese imports that are set to jump from 10% to 25% in the new year.
Better to spend now and have it ready to sell rather than having to purchase more that cost more down the road.
This macroeconomic data matches what we've been hearing from public companies as they report their quarterly earnings. Matt McDonald is a partner with Hamilton Place Strategies, which analyzed transcripts from recent corporate earnings calls.
The trade discussion has edged out tax reform for the first time. And when they're talking about trade, they're almost all talking about tariffs.
For example, Ford has estimated the Trump administration's trade policy will cost the company $1 billion this year, in part due to higher steel prices and tariffs on imports from China.
It does feel like from both the way companies are talking about it and from what we see in the GDP numbers that the impact is starting to bite.
At least at the country and company level. Consumers just aren't feeling it yet. A majority of respondents to a recent Marketplace Edison research poll, 52%, said tariffs have no impact on them personally. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've gotten some insights into the fortunes of a couple of key technology companies as they have reported earnings this week. One key insight in particular, how many people use their services? Snap, the owner of Snapchat, lost 2 million daily active users in its most recent quarter. Twitter saw its active user base drop as it boots more fake accounts. We'll get Facebook's active user count when it reports earnings next week. But as important as they are to the companies, though, those user counts might actually be more important to investors. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, they're nothing without their users.
Social media companies spend a ton of money and time and effort trying to draw in active users.
Karen North is a professor at USC's Annenberg School. Twitter broadcasts football games to draw in more people. Facebook has had actual online ad campaigns.
Chairs are for people. And that is why chairs are like Facebook.
But the best and often main way to get more active users is through the ones you got.
I want to use Snapchat or Facebook because my friends are using it.
Dean Eccles is a professor at MIT's Sloan School. So to the extent they care about total users, social media companies focus on existing user engagement.
Are people sharing things that their friends are going to want to see? How many users on Snap are actually sending new snaps?
In fact, those metrics can be more informative as to the health of a company than its total user base. Brian Weiser is with Pivotal Research. He says it's a little misguided to obsess about changes in total number of active users.
I think sometimes this gets overstated in importance from quarter to quarter by investors.
Advertisers, the people who are paying Facebook or Twitter money, he says don't change their ad spend based on a social media company's changing total user base.
Specific number of users in a given quarter isn't particularly important.
And Twitter, for example, often reaches more people than its users would suggest. Again, Karen North.
Most of us, the bigger audience, we don't need to be on Twitter to hear about what happened on Twitter.
Meaning that a company's total number of active users doesn't tell the whole story. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you've got a Netflix account, you know the company tries real hard to personalize pretty much everything. I get a lot of history stuff suggested, some rom-coms too, to be honest. But sometimes that personalization gets a little bit complicated because there's a difference between stuff being personalized and you kind of being profiled. Natasha Tiku covers Silicon Valley for Wired. She wrote about Netflix and what it knows about you and how it shows you what it knows about you. Natasha, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me how you came upon this story, would you?
Sure. So earlier this month, a writer named Stacia Brown, she posted some artwork that Netflix had served her for a new movie called Like Father, and she posted this on Twitter.
Yeah.
So rather than the film's two white co-stars, Kelsey Grammer and Kristen Bell, she saw a poster showing two black side characters who, as Brown said, had maybe 20 lines between them, tops. And Brown is black, and she asked other black Netflix users if they were experiencing the same phenomenon. And she also, along with it, posted some other artwork that she'd seen for movies like Love Actually, where she was shown black side characters who had very small roles in the film.
So there's a part of this that's creepy that Netflix is keeping an eye on us, which we do kind of know about, but also now they're doing this in a, I get this is kind of a loaded term, and they're doing it kind of in a bogus way, right?
Right. Well, the company's response was that, you know, they don't ask members about their race, gender, or ethnicity, so they can't use that information to personalize your Netflix experience.
But they know what we watch, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. They're personalizing it based on your viewing history, and this particular phenomenon happened because last year they started drilling down personalization even to the level of the artwork that you're seeing in your Netflix queue. They're applying the algorithm to kind of inherently biased database, right? Like Hollywood movies don't offer many parts to
exactly.
people of color and prominent roles. So Netflix is here. They're just trying to get you to keep watching, doing anything they possibly can. But what viewers said is that they, you know, they should have anticipated this coming, and the fact that they can't just be candid about all of the proxies for race that exist in algorithms is just kind of frustrating, because here it's actually pretty innocuous. Their algorithm, say, probably was just looking at, hey, can we get people to watch movies based on secondary characters? You know, they might not even have plugged that in.
Right. Secondary characters who go away in the first 10 minutes of a movie or whatever. So a couple of things about, of things about all that. Number one, Netflix is taking the time, effort, and energy to personalize this stuff down to the thumbnail on your screen, which seems like a lot of effort, I suppose, but I guess it works.
You know, once you automate that and you have machine learning doing it, it's just kind of spinning on its own.
The other part of this, though, is we don't know what we don't know, because Netflix keeps all of its data extremely closely held.
Exactly. I mean, say they didn't want to answer questions about these sensitive topics, but they wouldn't even tell me, okay, well, what about your viewing history? Are they cataloging? You know, what are the factors that they're using? They didn't even feel comfortable sharing that. I think they said it's like proprietary information.
It's not just what you see on Netflix that algorithms get used for, right?
They are being used in many areas, even outside of tech companies. They're used to determine, you know, who gets access to a loan. They're used for hiring, recruitment, all kinds of very impactful areas of our lives online.
Natasha Tiku writes for Wired, most recently about Netflix and its algorithms and what it wants you to watch, I guess. Natasha, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Coming up.
Beautifully, she transformed and became the most amazing dog ever.
First your dog, and then your life. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 296 today, 1.1%, closed at 24,688. Not as bad as it could have been. The blue chips off 539 at one point. NASDAQ down 151, that is 2%, 7167. The S&P 500 dipped 46 points, 1.7%, 26.58. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow Industrial is down 2.9%, the NASDAQ off 3.7%. S&P 500 sank 3.9%. Kind of tough in tech. Toughest perhaps for Snap, as we told you. Disappearing users, not a good thing. Shares plunged 10% today. Twitter also lost some users. As we mentioned, continues to purge fake accounts. Better than expected revenue growth, though, so Twitter found 1.7% today. Disappointing quarterly report from Amazon preceded today's 7.8% share price decline. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. Sign up for our daily e-newsletter by October 31st, and you could be in for a Halloween treat. We're giving away 10 Marketplace treat bags filled with some great swag, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what goes into bringing you the program every single day, a rundown that I will sign personally. Subscribe today at marketplace.org. for your chance to win, and good luck. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. We've got a brand new episode of Make Me Smart for you to listen to every week. We connect the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture. And this week, we're talking about college tuition between the scholarships, federal and private loans, and grants. Why, oh, why is the financial aid process around higher education so darn confusing?
Yeah, so of course I agree with you. Consumer transparency is a huge issue, and it is my view that some colleges are purposely opaque, I would say, because it is in their interest to hide the true cost of their school, because otherwise you won't go because it's so crazily expensive.
Make Me Smart. Check it out.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. This one gets filed straight into the I totally did not know that folder. But you know all the data that gets stored up in the cloud, as the saying goes? Well, it turns out all the big tech companies, Amazon, Google, all the big ones, they back up their cloud servers on magnetic tape. It seems so old school, right? But there is a problem, and it's not with the tape. Just two companies make the tape that a big chunk of the internet is backed up on too, and each wants the other out of the business. Susan Decker is the patents reporter for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, how are you doing today, Kai?
I'm well, thank you. But I will be completely honest and tell you that I read this story and I said, they're still using tape for cloud backup? Explain to me how this works.
You know, old school sometimes is the best. The storage on a cloud obviously is just basically somebody else's server. But when you need long-term archival storage, you want something separated from the internet and you want something that's going to hold massive amounts of data, even more than a server. And that's where the tape comes in.
And the experts say that tape is the medium of choice because
it's cheap, it's good, it's reliable, and it stores a heck of a lot of data.
Yeah, and cheap is important with all that data, right? I mean, I don't even know what gets bigger than terabytes, but we have a lot of them.
Yeah, a terabyte is equivalent to about a million books. Huh. Right now, a single LTO7 linear tape can hold about 15 terabytes, so that's about 15 million books on one tape, on one cartridge.
Okay. Now, there's a corporate story here, right? It's Sony and Fujifilm are the makers of this tape that everybody now uses and will be using for a while, and they're sort of at loggerheads here. Explain what's going on.
So there's a basic standardized technology that was developed by IBM, HP, and Quantum. It's called the Linear Tape Open. There used to be six manufacturers. Now there's two. And those two have said, oh, you're using my patents and patented inventions. And the other one says, no, you're using my patented inventions. And each one has filed complaints at the International Trade Commission here in Washington, trying to shut the other one out of the U.S. market.
The catch, of course, is that if there's only one supplier of this tape and we're using it to back up basically everything, that's an issue.
And that's the concern of the hardware companies. They have filed some papers with the ITC saying, please don't shut either of them out. We want to have multiple suppliers. Both of them, by the way, are in Japan. Yeah. So there are concerns about what happens if there's another earthquake, what happens if there's another tsunami that shuts down operations.
Give me the upshot of all these suits and countersuits and decisions and whatnot. We are dependent, it seems, on backing up basically the entire internet on just two companies.
True.
That seems like a challenge.
It is. There are some older versions of the tape, but the hardware companies, they want the newest version. They developed the standard to put ever more stuff on these tapes. So if only one's in, they would either have to pay higher prices for one, or they would have to use these older tapes that have less data.
Right. It's so interesting because you hear people say, oh, it's up in the cloud all the time, right? And you think of this ephemeral thing, but it's actually really tangible, a physical product.
Well, think about it. I mean, if you have software and there's a bug that's introduced into that software, that bug will go on and on and on. But if there's a physical version of it on tape, then that bug doesn't touch the tape, and that's how you can recreate it. And so, you know, I've spoke to a number of people during the reporting of my story, and they were all saying, basically, this is what keeps the world running.
Wow. Susan Decker, she's the patents correspondent at Bloomberg. Susan, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
From the American Pet Products Association comes the setup for this next story. In 2017, we, that is Americans,
spent more than $69 billion on our pets. Full disclosure, part of that came from me. About $6 billion of it, though, give or take, went for services like grooming and training, which gets us to the point. A series we do called My Economy, how people's personal economies are doing away from the big economic headlines. Here you go.
My name's Renee Bogarts. I'm a dog trainer, and I started Dingo Doggies in 2014, and I live in Santa Monica, California. Before 2014 was a little bit rough for me personally. I'd come out of a relationship quite abruptly that I didn't see coming. I found that a lot of my happiness came from when I was with my dogs. The dog I rescued, her name was Lola. I took her home, and it was very, very hard. She was so fearful, and she'd wet herself and she'd get aggressive. And every day, all I did was watch Animal Planet and talk to trainers and talk to vets and try clicker training and try treats and whatever she'd respond to in a positive, confident manner, I would keep doing. Beautifully, she transformed and became the most amazing dog ever. I started getting random calls from people. Hi, you don't know me, but one of my neighbors said that you had this crazy dog and you transformed it. I was wondering if you could help me with my dog. I would say, sure, I'll come and take a look. And then they told their friends because it worked. At the same time, I was working in restaurants. I didn't have the main source of income from doing the dogs. You know, I was making $40 some days. Other days I made nothing. So in the beginning, I really wasn't supporting myself. There came a point where I just said, okay, I need to start charging people and I need to get rid of this waitressing thing because there's not enough hours in the day. And so I started charging and people started paying, and it took a lot of energy and a lot of time out of me that I just bumped up the prices incrementally.
Knock, knock, Dingo Doggies. Sit. Good girl, Maya.
Dogs have really, in a sense, schooled me. I prefer their company over humans. I love the company of humans as well, but there's nothing better than having a great dog next to you.
There is nothing better. Huh? Drop us a line. Would you let us know how your economy is doing? You can do that at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, in which market capitalization proves its fleeting glory. You remember a month or two ago when Apple became the first publicly traded company in the world to be valued at $1 trillion, and then, like a week or something later, Amazon was as well? Yeah, well, all you companies still worth 10 figures, take one step forward. Amazon, not so fast. The company's troubles in the market the past month or so have cost the company that Jeff Bezos built more than $200 billion in market cap. It's down to $800 billion now. Jeff Bezos? He's still doing fine. All right, we are going down. Dow Industrials off 296 points today, 1.1%. NASDAQ off 151 points, that is 2%. S&P 500 dipped 46 points, 1.7% for the week. As I've been saying all week, number one, totally normal. But number two, yeah, it was ugly. You know. All right, our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.